1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for the series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, July 30th, 2009, the 40th day of summer. We have lost 2 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 14 minutes since last week. Daylight will continue to lessen until December 21st. So get out and enjoy nature. If you are a summer person, if you are an all-seasons person, still get out, but not so urgent, as you like the rain and snow as well as sunshine. The sun rose at 5:50 this morning. It will set at 8:13 this evening. We will have 14 hours and 23 minutes of daylight today. That is 45 minutes less than the first day of summer. Sunshine is waning, and that will be noticeable very shortly as afternoon shadows will foretell the approach of autumn. The moon will rise at 3:41 this afternoon. It will set at 12:48 tonight after midnight. We are 2 days past first quarter. The next full moon is August 6th, 1 week from today. Next high tides in New Rochelle will be 7:31 p.m. In Yonkers, 5:15 p.m. Dobbs Ferry, 5:43. Tarrytown, 5:59. Haverstraw, 6:25. We haven't heard from Haverstraw in a while. And in Peekskill at 6:38 p.m. Air quality today is at a number called 43. I don't know what that means. Maybe I'll find out someday. Now our regular feature, our sad feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives at war. May they live on in all of our hearts. Most recent report of American deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan combined is 5,081. The best estimate of Americans wounded in action in both countries is 34,750. And these are not scratches. Many Americans who come back have lost a limb, are addled in their mind. They're seriously injured. It's a tremendous trauma for them and for their families. And our hearts go out to those injured as well as to those who were killed. Those who were killed in the last week: Private First Class Donald W. Vincent, age 26. He was a Marine. He's born and lives in Gainesville, Florida. He was killed in combat operations in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, on July 25th. Specialist Justin D. Coleman, age 21. He was an Army man, 10th Mountain Division from Spring Hill, Florida. He was killed when enemy forces attacked his unit with small arms and rocket-propelled grenades in Nuristan Province, Afghanistan, on July 24th. That was just last Friday. Sergeant Ryan H. Lane, age 25, he was a Marine from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, died in combat operations in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, on July 23rd. Marine Lance Corporal Jeremy S. Lasher, age 27, he was from Oneida, New York, one of two Marines killed during combat in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, on July 23rd. The other in that same incident was Corporal Nicholas G. Sharos, age 21, of Yarmouthport, Massachusetts. Two soldiers were killed by a roadside bomb in Zabul Province, Afghanistan, on July 22nd. They are Specialist Randy L. J. Neff, Jr., age 22, so young, from Blackfoot, Idaho, and Sergeant Joshua J. Reimer, also very young, 24, from Rochester, Pennsylvania. Both were with the 555th Engineer Brigade. And finally, Specialist Herberth A. Berrios Campos, age 21. He was a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne Division from Bealetown, Virginia. He died in a non-combat-related incident in Salmon Park, Iraq, on July 24th. Three of these eight brave men were alive last Thursday when last we broadcast. Three others were killed on last Thursday and two on the day before our last broadcast. Each of these deaths is a great loss to their families and to all Americans and to me personally. May they live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Ordinarily, we'd have our culture corner, which is my reviews of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, and what have you. And you have to keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. I say ordinarily because there is nothing to report today. So There are no opinions. However, tonight we're going to see West Side Story, and we will report on that in our next program in 2 weeks. So if you want to know how West Side Story was, I don't yet know. You will soon know. You are listening to AM 1460 WBOX in New Rochelle. If you're listening if you are an inmate in Tippecanoe, Indiana County Jail, or elsewhere in Tippecanoe, if you're listening in Tyler, El Paso, Canton, or Texarkana, Texas, or Fredericksburg, Texas, or Virginia, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live. Okay, my first guest today is Richard Esguerra. He's an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. So he got up real early this morning to come to the office and see us, which I appreciate. His title is actually activist, so he's not just an activist, he is the activist. As his title, while he is not a techie, he certainly knows more about the technical issues than do I. Makes me wonder about the employees of EFF who actually are techies. EFF, simply stated, is an organization of good guys which protects our electronic rights. We'll find out in a minute what that means. Just as the Industrial Revolution was an age, the space age is an age, seminal times in the history of the human animal, so is the digital age, which we are going through rapidly as we speak. This is the digital age. Of course, there are abuses, and they know no national boundaries. Across the globe, governments try to restrict access to information, and scoundrels try to take advantage of media to enrich themselves. That would be either thieves or terrorists, actually. To tell us more about issues and programs which EFF, that's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, addresses, welcome Richard Esguerra.
Hi there, Rob.
Good morning. How are you doing in San Francisco today?
I'm doing all right.
And the weather is?
Well, it's been a cloudy, a damp morning. We've had a kind of a light drizzle for the last few days, so it's just been this long-lasting kind of dampness in the air.
Now, how do you feel about dampness and rain and stuff?
Well, all I have to say is that I was expecting to have a bit of a summer, but I don't seem to be getting one, at least yet.
Sounds like you're a bit disappointed.
Yeah, just a little bit.
But. Yeah, well, I personally enjoy the overcast, but I'm kind of screwy that way. When the bright sun, I kind of avoid because it hurts my eyes. Anyway, we have you, and not just to chit-chat, but since you are with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an organization which I had not heard of, and once I started reading about it, I was fascinated by what you do. So let's get started. The big issue during the Bush years was warrantless wiretapping. And some feel that it was the right thing to do. Some feel that whatever measures must be taken to protect Americans, like wiretapping and torture, they're legal no matter what. Other Americans, like myself, believe that our Constitution is strong enough to protect us against all enemies and that the values we uphold define us as a nation, and we are diminished when those values are compromised. So how does EFF address that broad issue on the ground day to day?
Well, our work on warrantless wiretapping has revolved essentially around a lawsuit that we filed in 2006. This lawsuit is called Hepting v. AT&T. This was a class action lawsuit on behalf of AT&T customers. So just to give a little background as to why we wound up filing a lawsuit is a short time before we heard from a whistleblower who worked for AT&T. It's a very heroic man named Mark Klein. And he came by and he had evidence. He had these documents that showed that in San Francisco, the NSA had a room, 614A, where technicians had hooked up a number of variety of equipment. And this equipment generally, when we took a look at it and sort of specced it out and sent it to some experts in the field, the equipment was designed to do sort of two main things. One is to receive a copy of the data traffic that was passing through AT&T's facility in San Francisco, so that's one. And two, was to process this traffic in a real-time manner, so in a manner that might allow them to search for things in these communications records or this data. So what we thought that we had and what we believe we have is evidence of massive dragnet warrantless wiretapping by the government.
So who were they tapping?
Well, it was indiscriminate. With the way the system was set up, the facility or the room in AT&T's facility would receive a copy of everything passing through.
Well, how can you you mean every phone call that anybody made, or is this just overseas calls or what?
Well, there's a little bit of ambiguity about this, and this is one of the sort of the targets of the lawsuit is we want to find out a little bit more about what exactly would it be. With the way the system was set up, it was there was the fiber coming through, and the fiber carries any kind of all sorts of data. So it could include just a lot of different things. But one thing's for sure, it's the data of AT&T customers that's going through there. And it was making a full-fledged, straight-up copy that got diverted to this secret room where often an AT&T technicians would need security clearances to be allowed to go into that room and work on some of the equipment.
But how can you listen to so much? I mean, the chatter is amazing. I mean, every wire and every fiber optic cable carries thousands of conversations at a time, I'm sure. How do you tune in on those that you might actually have an interest in rather than Aunt Sadie telling Margie what to wear on her next date?
Sure. Well, there's been a lot of analysis of this fact, and I think there's sort of two things that emerge. The first thing, I guess I'll probably try to answer your question directly and say that one of the pieces of equipment we noticed was something called a NERIS, or it was a server provided by, or rather it was hardware provided by a company called NERIS. And this company is known for real-time data processing technology. So this was one of the key signs that perhaps one of the things that they wanted to do in this facility was to really quickly search through records for certain things. So it's conceivable that there would be some sort of keyword matching where, you know, if someone says the word like bomb or terrorism, something along those lines, those communications could be, or those records or whatever, could be isolated and then become something that gets investigated further.
But people talk about bombs and terrorists all the time.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's sort of what has been emerging as a story that I think hasn't gone as well told. But a lot of the congressional research about this and a lot of the reports that Congress has mandated have come back saying that a lot of these warrantless wiretapping programs, they didn't yield anything interesting. What they did yield was a lot of noise.
Duh.
And that's exactly right. And they forced law enforcement agencies domestically and abroad to kind of waste their time trying to follow leads that turned out to be science teachers
Another wonderful use of taxpayer money.
Exactly.
But the bigger issue, let's say, would be the legality and the challenging of rights issues right there. Anyway, let's say they could focus on what they really wanted and what might actually be valid intelligence information. What is the objection to the government listening? And right wingers say this all the time. Say, "Well, they were just trying to protect us. What's wrong with that?" And of course, the issue: how do you balance the Constitution, which guarantees us privacy, with desire, however misguided and illegal and unconstitutional it may be, to protect us?
Well, the Constitution, I think, and you put it really wonderfully in your introduction, the Constitution is a document that really provides us the rights that have really led to this way of life and really lead to sort of the robustness of this sort of American lifestyle. So the Constitution needs to be protected. And as it's being shown, what's really worked, what's really been most effective as far as, you know, enforcement of these laws and protection has gone, is sort of this old-fashioned police work. You get leads. You follow these leads. You when you have probable cause, you move in and you investigate and you escalate that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's shown to be most effective, and that's what we should be aiming to return to, as opposed to this sort of status that we have now, where we have these warrantless wiretapping programs with mass surveillance, these fusion centers, this kind of move towards a bit of an Orwellian surveillance.
Yes. So what would happen if we followed the Constitution? Is the Constitution, in fact, strong enough that it would protect us if we followed its mandate? Would we be protected, or is the document not modern enough? Is it too weak to protect us from terrorism and other threats?
Well, no. I think the document stands strong, and I think we would be able to protect ourselves. I think that, you know, we've put ourselves in a bit of a position where we're in a bit of a position where there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of sort of rash decisions being made on the basis of that fear. And we can only hope that the work that we've been doing to sort of find out more about the warrantless wiretapping and expose sort of the injustice that it's being committed, you know, against Americans, and also the level to which it's sort of being hidden or swept under the rug, that all these things are very wrong, really, and that we can continue to move forward into a better future and a more secure future if we move forward with our constitutional protections intact.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We are speaking with Richard S. Guerra. He's an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. And the other big issue I'd like to address with you is there's a piece of software called Tor, T-O-R, which comes from the Onion Router software, which perhaps you can explain. And it's a way for people to get information and communicate online without being tracked. And my understanding is that with the, speaking about Iran right now, where the government is trying to crack down on communication and keep their people in the dark, and to a certain extent also in China, how does this software and what is your role or EFF's role in the use of and the distribution of this Tor software?
Sure. Well, so I believe it was a bit early in the 2000s, maybe even shortly before that, but we got wind that some folks were working on the software called Tor, the Onion Router. And the way it works is, normally when you're on the internet and your computer kind of makes a request for a web page, so you want to see the front page of the New York Times. Essentially, what your computer does is it sort of shouts, "Hey, I would like the New York Times, please," and that message gets routed to the New York Times, and then it sends it back. And since it's something akin to a shout, many people sort of that are along the line of communication that's developed to conduct this interaction, they know what's being asked for.
So anybody who wants to know if you're reading the New York Times or who's reading the New York Times just listens to the shout, say, "Okay, there's one, there's one, there's one."
Right, right.
Okay.
It isn't quite that wide open, but anybody that sits along the network that's being used, and often this can be quite extensive. So,
okay.
In any case, what Tor does is it's software that you run on your computer that essentially gives you access to sort of a network of computers that have agreed to, instead of yell, they've agreed to whisper these requests to one another. So you make a whispered request to another computer for the New York Times website, and that computer makes a whispered request to another computer, and so on and so forth. So what happens is it sort of breaks the chain where it's so very clear who's asking, who was the original person who asked for the website.
So somebody who's monitoring would say, "Oh, somebody's reading the New York Times now," but they would get lost kind of in the swamp if they tried to figure out who it was?
Right.
And
they
swamp
would only see the last computer to make the request. They would only see that one,
okay,
but that one would be so very far, so many hops away,
yeah,
from the original one that made the request.
So that it would be prohibitive, if possible at all, to even find the original requester.
Yes, exactly.
Terrific.
So we heard about Tor, I guess, in the early 2000s. So we actually helped them. We helped, I believe we helped fund the project in some ways. Now Tor is its own full-fledged project. They've sort of broken off from us, not in any bad way, just in the way that they became self-sufficient and have been able to develop the project on their own.
So in the next 2.5 minutes, how is this being applied in places like Iran and China?
Well, in places like that, where you have repressive regimes that are interested in probably two things, as far as the internet's concerned, they're interested in censorship, so they don't want their citizens to see certain types of information. That's one, and two, they're interested in surveillance. If there are people that are using the internet for things that they disagree with, then they want to be able to see that. Tor is turning out to be a way for these dissidents and even just these citizens that want to be involved politically. It's a way for them to evade censorship and remain anonymous for some of the communications they're sending. And in that, it protects their lives. It protects them from becoming a target of the state security apparatus, which, in a case like Iran, we've sort of seen being exercised in different ways. So it really is starting to be a great tool to help keep these people involved and connected and help other people outside the country sort of know what's happening inside.
So in Iran today, people are using Tor.
Yes, definitely. And as a matter of fact, sort of as our contribution, we released a guide called Surveillance Self-Defense International,
fabulous,
which explains how to use Tor for those people and also explains for people outside of the country how they can help by running Tor nodes, which help enrich the network and make it faster for
You know, I find this really not only fascinating, but very practical and very, very important, I think. The name of the organization is Environmental Frontier Foundation, and so if you forget the website, which we'll give you in a second, just Google Environmental Frontier Foundation. If you're really interested, if you're a techie or not a techie, or just politically astute, or you're just interested, please look them up. And the actual website is what, Richard?
It is EFF.org.
Well, that's pretty easy to remember. EFF for Environmental Frontier. Electronic. I'm so used to saying environmental. Electronic Frontier Foundation or EFF.org. I guarantee that you will find it quite interesting. Richard, you have about a minute. What else would you like to say? First of all, can anybody get tour, and in this country, would anybody want it?
Yes, I think it's absolutely true that anyone would want it. Here in this country, we have a sort of a growing population of advertisers that are tracking what you do online. You know, whether you want them to be doing that or not, Tor is something that can help you with that issue.
Okay.
So even beyond some of the government surveillance implications, even in sort of less repressive regimes, you know, Tor can be useful.
And how do people get it?
Well, they can head to the website. It's torproject.org.
So that's torproject.org?
Yep, that's right.
And just download it from there?
Yep, they can download it from there. They'll find great instructions there and, tons of resources for folks that want to use it.
Richard, it's been great talking to you. We have about 30 seconds. Anything you'd like to say?
Well, nothing more than please visit the website. We do a lot of great work, and it's an exciting time to sort of be working on these issues.
I agree that you do a lot of great work. Okay, Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you are listening online, never mind that. I am Bob Lebensold, your host. We have some more guests coming up from Oceana, which is the organization that looks out for our oceans, after the break, and we will be right back.
Helping you keep your cool all summer long. AM 1460 WVOX.
Fox News Radio, I'm Don Matheson. They'll hoist a few brewskis. This evening, President Obama, Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates, and the cop who arrested Gates, Sergeant James Crowley, will sit down together for a beer.
White House aides say there isn't any formal agenda, but the hope is the image of the professor and the police officer sitting down to discuss their differences will be a positive image to the country.
Fox's Mike Emanuel. Committee votes possible today on health care reform, this following a compromise between House leaders and conservative Blue Dog Democrats.
It gets the bill moving again, but some Blue Dogs and some liberal Democrats are unhappy with the deal. Meanwhile, Republicans say the Democrats' plans won't work.
Fox News Radio's Mike Makowicz. The Republicans' number three ranking member splitting from the leadership. Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee says he'll vote to confirm Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. He's only the sixth Republican to voice support for Sotomayor. Fox News, we report, you decide.
From the Fox Business Network, the most powerful name in business news, a full plate of quarterly earnings reports today, everything from cosmetics to garbage. We'll start with ExxonMobil, where profits were down 66% as oil prices and demand fall. Companies posting losses include Goodyear Tire and Rubber, Eastman Kodak, and Dow Chemical, although excluding one-time items, Dow would have earned a profit in the quarter. Declines in profits reported at Travelers Insurance, International Paper, Avon Cosmetics, and Trash Hauler Waste Management, due mainly to a drop in recycling prices. On the plus side, cereal maker Kellogg's made a profit, as did fellow consumer products firm Colgate-Palmolive. Better-than-expected earnings were posted by MasterCard, and for the first time in a couple of years, electronics maker Motorola turned a quarterly profit. If you own stock in General Electric, you got some good news today. A ratings upgrade by Goldman Sachs. That's likely to send GE shares higher. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Chris Cotter.
The challenge, a 12-egg omelet in one sitting.
Breakfast, the most important meal of the day? Try most enormous.
30 inches of pizza.
I think I'm getting a little pizza drunk.
6 nuclear wings.
What do you guys make that with? Plutonium?
The challenger, one hungry man.
My kind of odds.
Adam Richman has the travel bug, and it's taking him across the country tackling the biggest and boldest food challenges around. Man versus food. Catch it Wednesdays at 10 Eastern and Pacific, only on the Travel Channel.
From sock drawers to piggy banks, saving has taken many forms. But when you're looking for a better way to save, at Wachovia, we're with you. That's why there's the Way to Save program. With Way to Save, $1 is automatically transferred from checking to savings when you use your check card to make a purchase or pay certain bills online. And you'll get a bonus just for saving. Call 800-WACOVIA, visit wachovia.com/waytosave, or stop by and find out how the Way to Save program can help you. Wachovia, a Wells Fargo company. Wachovia Bank, N.A., Wachovia Bank of Delaware, N.A., members FDIC.
The hottest, most welcoming bar, the in-place in Manhattan these days, is not some anonymous hidden-away spot downtown. It's right smack in the middle of Manhattan. And are you ready for this? It's located in the famous Le Cirque restaurant, America's most celebrated dining venue. Right there, on East 58th Street, between Lexington and 3rd, in the dramatic courtyard of the Bloomberg Building, you'll find the happening place in town, Le Cirque's new wine bar. It's elegant, all right. It's also casual, with a very sexy, romantic, glamorous atmosphere. No jackets or ties ever required at the bar at Le Cirque, the wonderful new meeting place with a dazzling bar menu from Le Cirque's three-star kitchen, and all at very reasonable prices. Attractive people of all ages have discovered the Maccioni family's latest midtown hit, open late every evening except Sunday. It's fancy, but casual and informal and great fun. The bar at Le Cirque at 58th between Lex and 3rd, and take note, the only name you need to get into Le Cirque is your own. So say hello to Cirio Maccioni's sons, Marco and Mauro, and try one of their 30 wines by the glass at the hot new Manhattan Inn spot, the bar at Le Cirque, 58th between 3rd and Lex.
WVOX is the station that never sleeps. Hello, I'm Judy Fremont, president of the station, with information you'll want to know about. If you want your message on the air immediately, our Whitney Media sales team is there for you 24/7. Call us anytime, day or night, at 914-636-1460 and ask for our sales team. We'll get back to you right away. 914-636-1460. The station that never sleeps. 914-636-1460.
Here's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity on this Thursday, 30th day of July, and we're starting off with a little bit of cloud cover for the morning hours. The frontal system that moved through is going to give us some pretty good weather for today. It'll become mostly sunny with our high temperatures ranging into the mid to upper 80s on west winds. Partly cloudy for this evening, a chance of showers and thunderstorms overnight, nighttime lows into the upper 60s. Friday's weather, showers and some thunderstorms mainly in the afternoon. High temperatures for the day will range into the lower 80s. Chance of rainfall tomorrow, 80%. More showers and thunderstorms likely on Friday night. Nighttime lows will settle back in the mid-60s. The outlook for Saturday, a mostly sunny day, upper 80s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for Whitney Media, WVOX, WVIP.
1460 WVOX.
We are back. You're listening to Environmentally Sound on WVOX AM 1460 here in New Rochelle. Before we get to our next guests, I'd like to tell you about my friends at The Learning Shop, who bring you this program. Their number is 914-835-1070. They're located in Harrison, as I say. Now, there are all kinds of businesses. There are all kinds of tutoring companies. But The Learning Shop is set apart by their personnel and their company culture. This is not a stuffy place. There's something about education that invites structure without rigidity, discipline without anxiety, teaching without stuffiness. This is not a stuffy place. The management and staff at The Learning Shop are friendly, educated, and flexible. They're not just intelligent, but smart, and the distinction is an important one. Most teachers are intelligent, but that is kind of an internal trait. When intelligence comes out into the room and has the ability to touch others, it becomes smart. John and Paul head up the operation. Their even-tempered personalities inspire the atmosphere of relaxed learning. They're also fine tutors in their own right. It is a pleasure to visit their facility. There's always a friendly space in which to share ideas for students to study in quiet and harmony. And when I go there, there's always nice coffee and some kind of snack. And that's just personal. If you or someone you know could benefit from private instruction, give The Learning Shop a call. Again, telephone number in Harrison is 914-835-1070, and they do contract with many school districts, so if they're trusted by the public education people, you know that they're trustworthy. Ask for John or Paul. Let them custom tailor a program for you or your school-age son or daughter or your parent or your grandmother, anybody who needs to learn something. You will be very happy with their services. Again, 914-835-1070. My next guests are Diane Science and Jackie Savitz. They're with Oceana, which is the Washington, D.C.-based worldwide organization that keeps its eye on the world's oceans and does its best to publicize that which we need to know in order to protect this incalculably precious resource. Diane is Director of Communications. Jackie is a Senior Campaign Director. She's right now doing the Climate and Energy Campaign. Speaking to us from Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, welcome Diane Science and Jackie Savitz.
Thanks, Bob.
Hi, Bob. Thanks a lot.
Hi. It's my pleasure to have you both, and perhaps I will get to identify your voices as we go on. How is the weather in D.C. this morning?
Well, it's beautiful here this morning.
Yes.
Cooled off a little bit, and this is Jackie's voice.
Hi, Jackie. It did cool off a little, but yet the sun is shining, right?
Yes.
Kind of like it is here, too.
Can't complain.
Diane, let me ask you first, just give us an overview of Oceana, what it is, what it does, and how effective you've been.
Sure. Oceana is an international ocean conservation group. We employ staff in North America, South America, Central America, and Europe. And our core mission is to protect and restore the world's oceans. And Jackie manages a very aggressive campaign focused on climate change and educating people about how their energy choices impact our climate.
Okay, you say protect and restore. I can understand the protect, but what can you do to restore what has already been destroyed?
Well, the chief threats to the ocean are overfishing. We're taking too many fish out of the ocean on a regular basis, and the primary culprits are commercial fishing vessels. Pollution, such as runoff from agricultural pesticides and fertilizers, and then climate change. We are emitting too many greenhouse gases, and the ocean absorbs up to a third of those gases, which changes the overall chemistry of the ocean and makes it more difficult for some organisms to survive.
Now, you say we're overfishing. Could we actually run out of fish?
Well, scientists are studying that now. And there are a number of species that are really struggling to survive.
So are you saying that there really is not enough fish to feed all the people that want it? Now, I go to the fish market, and I don't buy fish. I don't eat fish because I don't like what we're doing to them. But I do notice the prices, and they're just kind of like meat prices, $4 or $5 a pound. Some of the exotic species, tuna and swordfish and all, are maybe $8, $9. But that's what you expect to pay for beef. It's not too expensive to buy, and it's probably better for you, and more food per weight because you don't have heavy bones. What encourages us not to eat fish?
Can I jump in here?
Sure, Jackie.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't really work on the fish campaigns, but what we're really trying to shoot for is sustainable fishing practices, and that is to make sure that we're not taking out more fish than what can ultimately be replaced by the fish populations. And it'd be really tough for a consumer like yourself or myself to know when we go to the grocery store whether or not we're choosing a fish that has been fished sustainably or not. But that would really be the smartest thing if we wanted to do that, would be to try to pick a fish that's fished sustainably. And there are a couple tools out there that help us do that. We've put out with another organization sort of a wallet guide that you can carry with you, and it indicates which fish are in sort of a red zone, like Chilean sea bass, which we know are heavily overfished, versus a fish like tilapia, which is in the green zone, which is farm-raised and sustainably fished.
So how do people find out which is which?
Well, what they want to do is get a wallet card. You can get one on our website at www.oceana.org. And that's probably the easiest way. There's also a group called the MSC, which is the certification group that tries to say whether or not a fish has been sustainably caught. But that's a little bit more debatable. The best thing to do is to get a wallet card, carry it with you in your wallet. When you're at the restaurant or a grocery store, just pull it out, and there you'll have your answer.
Okay, now, Jackie, you're director of campaign director for the senior campaign director. I want to get right for climate.
That doesn't mean I'm old, by the way.
For the climate and energy campaign, and and climate and energy. So climate, we're talking about global warming. Everybody talks about it. And if they don't talk about it, they think about it. But we still hear, boy, is it cold. Global warming is a bunch of hooey. So perhaps we need to hear the difference between the misnomer global warming and the far more accurate climate change. What is the difference, and how are the oceans and Oceana involved?
Sure. You know, climate change is a very, very large and diverse concept. There's a lot happening. And basically what's happening is we're pumping carbon dioxide and other pollutants into the atmosphere, and they're changing our climate in ways that we can already we can measure, and we can measure the increase in those gases, but we can also measure changes in temperature and unfortunately changes in the level of acidity in our ocean. And it's all being caused by gases like carbon dioxide, a pollutant like called black carbon, and methane, and a number of other gases. And what that does is it changes things like weather patterns. It can change the intensity of storms. I'm hearing music. Does that mean I need to stop?
Well, it means you have 30 seconds.
Okay. And it is causing an increase in the acidity of the oceans. So we may be looking at sea level rise. We may be looking at flooding in low-lying areas, potentially climate refugees. And there's some national security issues there as well, which I'd like to come back to.
Okay, and we will come back to those right after this break. We are speaking with Diane Science and Jackie Savitz of Oceana, the D.C.-based worldwide organization. And you're listening to WBOX AM 1460. This is Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levinsold, and we will be right back.
When you get overheated this summer, cool down with us.
Completely refreshing and so delicious.
AM 1460 WVOX.
Fox News Radio, I'm Don Matheson. They'll hoist a few brewskis. This evening, President Obama, Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates, and the cop who arrested Gates, Sergeant James Crowley, will sit down together for a beer.
White House aides say there isn't any formal agenda, but the hope is the image of the professor and the police officer sitting down to discuss their differences will be a positive image to the country.
Fox's Mike Emanuel. Committee votes possible today on health care reform, this following a compromise between House leaders and conservative Blue Dog Democrats.
It gets the bill moving again, but some Blue Dogs and some liberal Democrats are unhappy with the deal. Meanwhile, Republicans say the Democrats' plans won't work.
Fox News Radio's Mike Makowicz, the Republicans' number three ranking member, splitting from the leadership. Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee says he'll vote to confirm Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. He's only the sixth Republican to voice support for Sotomayor. Fox News, we report, you decide.
More and more young couples and families are discovering the benefits and advantages of living in beautiful New Rochelle. And the very best location with everything you can ever want for a young growing family is at the Lofts at New Rock. Luxury apartments perched atop New Rock City at an affordable price and so much more. The Lofts at New Rock residences are just one block from the Metro North Station and only 25 minutes to Grand Central. It all comes with access to what Newsweek calls one of the finest school systems in America, including free pre-K. Young professionals will appreciate an attended and monitored lobby. They're shopping with the Target store on the way and the New Rock movie complex with incredible restaurants. Smart, affordable living starts at the Lofts Apartments at New Rock City with a bird's eye view of the Long Island Sound and beyond with your own parking space in what Business Week calls one of the best places to raise children. So why pay $20,000 for pre-K in Manhattan? An incredible public school system is completely free to the residents at the Lofts at New Rock in one of the safest cities in America. Lovely apartments at the Lofts at New Rock begin with a limited time $8,000 federal tax credit refund for first-time buyers. And for a limited time, new buyers are being offered great incentives like membership to a prestigious New Rochelle Beach and Tennis Club and the New York Sports Club. You can live better for less at the Lofts at New Rock in New Rochelle. It's a Capelli enterprise, so you know it's quality living. Call 914-632-1200 in Westchester, 914-632-1200, or online at thelofts@newrock.com.
This is Marilyn Caselli from Con Edison. ConEd.com is better than ever with great energy tips for your home or business. Now you can report electric service problems online and check the status of service restoration. When severe weather's coming, our Storm Central webpage can tell you how to prepare for storms and what to do if your power goes out. You'll also find 100 things to know about conserving energy, electric and gas safety tips, and more. So check out ConEd.com. You'll be glad you did.
Con Edison, on it.
1460 WVOX.
Okay, we are back. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460, New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Wasilla, Alaska, Ottawa, Canada, or Ottawa County, Oklahoma, Alfalfa, or Antlers, Oklahoma, Belfast, Ireland, or Belfast, New York, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. We are speaking with Diane Sayans and Jackie Savitz of Oceana. Jackie, we were speaking about climate change, and we have about 10 minutes, so let's try to use that as wisely as possible. Finish up what you'd like to say about that, and then I'd like to go straight to the drilling for oil in U.S. waters issue. So at your own speed, address those, please.
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, I was saying that, you know, with climate change and sea level rise, we may be looking at climate refugees from low-lying countries and potentially wars over territory, but climate change is also going to cause shifts in agricultural production and water availability, which could lead to famine, water shortages, drought, potentially wars over food and water. So there's a real national security risk here. But the thing from Oceana's standpoint that we're most concerned about in the near term is, the, as Diane mentioned, the absorption of carbon dioxide into the ocean. They absorb about a third of it, so they're doing us a great service, but it's making them sick in the process. And what I mean by that is it's making the oceans more acidic, which makes it hard for animals like corals, clams, lobsters, crabs, and oysters to form their skeletons or their shells. And it's been predicted that the corals will suffer a mass extinction by 2050 if we go along with the business-as-usual scenario, if we don't find a way to shift away from our use of fossil fuels to a clean energy economy and look for reductions in carbon dioxide releases on the order of 25% to 40% by 2020.
So a lot of people could actually die.
Well, yeah, if you take it to its extreme,
to its extreme.
I mean,
and is that necessarily a bad thing for Earth and, and for the oceans?
Well, you know, I like to point out the Earth is going to be fine.
Good. I'm so happy to hear that. I don't really care about us as much.
It's just life as we know it that we're trying to preserve.
Okay.
And what that means, I think you introed, is this issue of offshore drilling. What does that mean from a climate change standpoint?
Yes. For climate change and for potentially disastrous pollution and oil spills.
Exactly. Thank you. I mean, you know, back in the day, we used to think offshore drilling was a bad idea because of the disastrous chance of pollution and oil spills and all the harms that would be created for marine life, everything from being coated to, you know, the toxic effects of oil to the destruction of their habitats. In fact, we believe that so strongly that the U.S. Congress, over 25 years, every single year, passed a moratorium against offshore drilling on the entire Atlantic coast and most of the Pacific coast. Even Republican Congresses, Democratic Congresses, every year for 25 years. And Republican and Democratic presidents also, George Bush, the first George Bush, and even Bill Clinton, had moratoria on offshore drilling. And it wasn't until last year, with the height of this very contentious presidential election, high gas prices, a hot summer, all kind of came together in a perfect storm to create sort of the drill baby drill momentum that lifted those moratoria and opened up for the first time both of our coasts to offshore drilling.
I would think that President Obama would quash that, wouldn't he?
Well, you know, President Obama hasn't squashed it yet, but he has, I think, when he came into office, and his Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, has sort of taken a step back and looked at the issue, you know, with calmer minds, I think, than we had last year. But it remains to be seen what they're going to do. But before they even got a chance to do anything, Senator Dorgan, decided that he wants there to be drilling in Florida, which is kind of surprising because he's not from Florida. And he put an amendment on a fast-moving energy bill in Congress that would open up the Gulf of Mexico on Florida's west coast, an area that was previously protected by a congressional compromise in 2006. A number of senators agreed to protect this area. 3 years later, he's saying, no way, let's drill here. No Florida senators were on the committee that made this decision to put this language in. And now that language to open up the Gulf for drilling is threatening to kill the climate bill, because this is a bill that's actually going to become part of the climate bill. And as a result, we're going to have a climate bill that's supposedly designed to solve climate change, but yet it's saying, hey, let's drill some more, which is exactly the opposite of what we need to be doing.
So is this actually what the people of the United States want, or is this special interest trying to skew the argument their way?
Well, I think it's special interest. I think it's brought to you by big oil. I don't think the people of the United States want agreements that are made by members of Congress and the Senate to be overturned 3 years after they're made. This area was supposed to be protected until 2022. Well, there's a chance that we could that this language could be killed because Senator Nelson of Florida is very concerned about it, and he's threatening to filibuster any bill that contains this language.
And where what has Obama said about this?
Obama hasn't said anything yet, which is a very good question. We would like
where is
to.
He? And what about Salazar, who has a bad reputation, as far as I'm concerned?
Well, they haven't said anything. They've got their process where they have their comment period going on now, but this area isn't even really part of that. This is an area that we thought was under control, and so we would like to hear from the president. We haven't heard yet what he thinks.
Does he know that you want to hear from him?
Yeah, I think so. I just said it on the radio.
Well, in case he's not listening to Environmentally Sound right now, are you whispering in senators' ears? And
yeah, we are. In fact, you know, the two senators from New York, Senator Gillibrand and Senator Schumer, are both very important players on this because they're going to get a chance to vote on whether Senator Nelson can keep this language out of the bill. And we're hopeful that New Yorkers will let their senators know that they don't think we should be opening up the Gulf after it was protected.
So people in our area who are concerned about this should contact Senator Schumer and Gillibrand and express their concerns and say that that this particular action is wrong. Now, just define it so they know what to call it.
Sure. It's the Florida drilling language in the Senate Energy Bill.
Okay. So the Senate Energy Bill, Florida drilling language.
Yep.
If you agree with us that it should be worded in a way that protects the oceans rather than destroys them and I'm not even that sure that it would save us even 2 cents at the pump. Most of these things don't.
Exactly.
Then please contact your senators and perhaps Nita Lowey as well.
And you make a great point because what there's a government agency called Energy Information Agency. They say that even if they opened all the areas that were previously protected on the Outer Continental Shelf, that's the area we're in discussion here, it would lower gas prices insignificantly, possibly pennies at the pump when it's at peak production, which isn't for 10 more years. So the truth is we've seen gas prices go up and down a lot more than that for a lot of other reasons, including conservation. So this really is not a reason to start drilling offshore. And we also know that the amount of oil that's available offshore is so small that it would not give us any additional energy independence. And so that's also not a good reason to go offshore. And finally, I'll just say that if they do drill offshore, they don't have to sell that oil even in the United States. It's most likely going to be sold in China or elsewhere. And so we take all the risk and we get none of the benefit.
Well, a lot of good reasons. That does go both ways because China takes all the manufacturing risks and all the pollution inherent there, and we use their products. So I think it's kind of a trade-off, an unpleasant one. You know what I'm saying, right? Their factories emit. It's terribly polluted there.
Fair point.
Yeah. So I think we're polluting. I don't know. It's just kind of crazy. We're all as a species, not just as Americans and Chinese, as a species, we are polluting terribly, and we need to cut that out. Okay. First of all, I'd like everyone to know again, website wise, it's Oceana, which is oceanwithana.org, is the place to visit if you'd like to know more about this and see the great work that this organization does. And the last item that I'd like to just broach in the couple of minutes left, even though we don't think of reptiles as warm and fuzzy, sea turtles kind of are warm and fuzzy. Are they endangered, threatened, and what are you doing to address that?
Yeah, would you believe that all of the sea turtles that are in U.S. waters, there are 6 species of sea turtles, every single one of them is either threatened or endangered.
Wow.
Under the Endangered Species Act.
And why is that? Is that because they get caught in fishermen's nets?
That's a really big part of it. Because of they get caught in fishermen's nets, because of pollution, and also because we've destroyed a lot of their habitat, their nesting beaches that they need, we've developed them. And so it's a lot harder for them to successfully reproduce as a result. And those 3 things combined make it very difficult for sea turtles to maintain their populations. So we're actually working on the Sea Turtle Protection Act, another bill in Congress that you can call your senators about,
okay.
Which would put in a number of different provisions that would help to protect sea turtles that we think are very important in reducing threats and protecting their habitat.
Great. Okay, thank you so much, Jackie. And Diane, we haven't heard much from you, but I know you're there, and I know that you've helped us out at the beginning. So thank you both, Diane Science and Jackie Savitz of Oceana in Washington. I did, by the way, volunteer at your table at the New York City Triathlon at the Sheraton last weekend. And,
that's great.
That's what inspired me to call back in, because I have interviewed someone from Oceana before.
We love our volunteers, and we're always looking for them.
Well, you'll have me again.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bob. We really appreciate it.
Okay, bye now.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
I would like to thank Richard Esguerra, Diane Science, and Jackie Savitz for speaking with us today. Coast to coast, America functions as it must in order to survive. Our West Coast people looking out for our right to communicate and acquire information. Our D.C. people keeping their watchful eye on the oceans. Both of these areas are, of course, global. The rights of Iranian citizens to acquire truth and communicate freely is just as important as our own. And of course, there are no boundaries on the oceans. The seas and oceans are all one. Our thought for the week, the ocean that toucheth thee toucheth me. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community radio station, the flagship of Whitney Radio. Stay tuned for Howard Sturman, the smiling publisher, astute, informed, patient, and open-minded. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here, and it is now. Health and happiness to you all.